have 35 minutes for questions. I'm going to start with the first question, and then I'll just kind of go back and forth between Slido and the microphone. Just the typical advisory, please make sure your question ends in a question mark. For those of you who don't know how to do that, you have to raise the pitch of your voice at the end of the sentence, and that indicates that you're not sure and you want to hear someone else's input. So please do that. There was a lot that I could touch on, but I've been on a panel in the past, because I also have published on entrepreneurship, and I made the comment that if I actually knew how to be an entrepreneur, I would probably be doing that instead of studying entrepreneurship. My wife is an entrepreneur. She has a business, and it's growing. It's doing great. And I'm an academic, and I'm very happy to have any kind of an income at all. I studied theology. And in fact, I remember even for the last decade or so, I find other academics studying theology, and they really have no idea the job market they're about to get into. So I try to tell them, you know, you need to think entrepreneurially. You got to think about what else can I do with these skills. And I still believe that is true, but I do wonder, to what extent can entrepreneurship be taught? And that's the question I want to start with. And we talked about a lot of the needed context. We talked about the needed character and values of the entrepreneur. But I mentioned Father Robert Sirico, founder of Acton Institute. He talked about the entrepreneurial vocation, right? A calling from God even. That's not something necessarily that a person can choose, something that's chosen for them. Now, I do think there are aspects that may be teachable, but to the extent that this is something we very much need today, and I believe it is, to what degree, what is the end of what we do, of studying it? To what degree can this actually be taught? And I guess I'll start there and allow you guys to chime in with any insights along those lines, and then we'll go to audience questions.
Oh, well, I think certain habits can be cultivated. The habit of awareness. I think there is a huge amount of rent seeking on the part of business school professors who want to continue teaching entrepreneurship, even if it can't be taught. And I think there are certainly some practical aspects of what it means to be an entrepreneur and not just be the dreamer, but actually implement it. But I've wrestled with that question, and it's not popular in the hallways and not popular in the faculty lounge.
There are some countries where entrepreneurship is obligatory. If you travel through a third world country, you will see people lining sidewalks with a towel or sheet spread out, and they have a bunch of trinkets for sale. They're doing their best to stay alive. Israel Kirzner defined entrepreneurship as something as simple as I walk into a room and it's dark, and I turn on the light switch. So I've taken existing resources and redirect them towards higher valued uses. That sort of habit, I think, can be something that's cultivated, and unshackling it by saying the government has no business in regulating this is fine. I worry that a lot of teaching entrepreneurship is like teaching people how to win the lottery. Imagine someone has won the lottery. I go to them and say, how did you choose your winning number? And they go into great detail because this was the single most important event in their life when they won $1 million. Well, the first four numbers were my wife's birthday, and the second two numbers were my dog's weight. And you're writing this down furiously as if that tells you anything about how to do what they did. So I'm worried that a fraud is being perpetrated by American universities and colleges by saying we're going to teach you about entrepreneurship. But it's not the fault of the universities. It's the fault of the culture that says to people, this is something that you can put together, and rather than a habit of mind that relies on independence and initiative.
Ramon, any
Yes, I think that entrepreneurship teaching can improve some tools to the entrepreneurs, but entrepreneur is something natural that you have. You can teach a person entrepreneurship, and he can not be willing to be entrepreneur because he is not willing to have some risk or to take risk. So entrepreneurs have very particular characteristics that I believe you cannot teach, but you can improve the tools that he can use. And I know people in my country that they do not know how to read or to write, but they are very good entrepreneurs, starting doing many things and got millionaires just doing what entrepreneurship means.
All right, let's start at the microphone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Joe Morris. I'm a lawyer, which means I am a transaction cost on the hoof. I'd like to see, Mr. Chairman, if I can draw connections between the first panel this morning and this one, and then see if I can pick a fight between Mr. Munger and Mr. Wenzel for the entertainment of the audience. Our first panel this morning was about Marxism, which, of course, teaches fundamentally that the economy is the basis of social life, and things like culture are superstructure, if it is the case that imperialism is the highest form of capitalism, then eroticism is the highest form of materialism, and by deconstructing, in the later stages of Marxism, deconstructing culture can be fun and a clever way of allying the work of Marx with the Adorno, Marcuse, Frankfurt School, and their American ally, Saul Alinsky, and deconstructing the society as a whole. The great conservative insight is to flip that. It is to say, in fact, culture is not superstructure. It is the basis of human existence. Culture precedes politics. Culture precedes the economy. That is to say, our religion, our values, our morals, our ethics, the trust that Mr. Parayada spoke about, part of that, builds the economy and builds all that's built upon it. So we can do a lot, borrowing from Mr. Wenzel's notion, that culture connected with culture is the telling of stories. We need to tell stories. We can, on a microscopic level, all of us be pointing out to our friends, our neighbors, the guy in the airplane seat, the grandchildren, that government, that war, for example, war is always and everywhere, almost always and everywhere, at least, a government program. Slavery, segregation, Jim Crow are almost always government programs. They don't occur without government power. Now, coming back then to the question of morality, Mr. Wenzel seemed to argue that the great moral force behind capitalism lies in the voluntariness of transactions. Mr. Munger seemed to argue that we ought to be judging morality by the altruistic outcomes that human behavior achieves. That the market, because market forces can be coercive rather than voluntary, we need to look at outcomes rather than processes. In Mr. Wenzel, I see the test of ethics being means testing. In Mr. Munger, I see the value of ethics being outcomes testing. Is there a divide between you on this point? Are we right in saying that it is culture, it is ethics, it is religion that undergird the rest of social structure? And at the heart of our ethics, should we be looking at the means ethics of things like voluntariness and honesty and trust, as Senor Parayada would have us do? Or should we be looking at the benefits, almost the utilitarian outcomes, the outcomes rather than the means, that I think I heard Mr. Munger suggesting?
Hey, gentlemen.
Well, I certainly think it's an old battle, and I remember staying up late in graduate school talking about the idea of Ayn Rand and others, that we need to look at the morality of capitalism only in its voluntariness and not in the outcomes, and then others like Milton Friedman arguing that it was the outcomes, perhaps, and looking at the Economic Freedom of the World Index and finding the resolution in Murray Rothbard, who spoke of the happy coincidence that capitalism is the only voluntary system and it is the one that feeds the poor and allows for human flourishing.
I would like to join in part and dissent in part from Judge Morris's opinion. He is quite right to say that my claim rests on the fact that markets often can be coercive. But I want, like my good friend Peter Betke, who as far as I can tell has by this point transcended physical form and has evolved into pure energy because he is invoked in all circumstances. We have to be comparativists. There's two different systems. They both suck. But if you're a liberal, the only thing you can be for is having people express their views through votes or having them express them through mostly voluntary exchanges and using the price mechanism. So that first one is much more coercive and therefore morally inferior. So it's what I worry about is that my side, and I hear many pro-market people make the absurd argument that markets are perfect and they're completely voluntary and there's no coercion. That's nonsense. They're just better than politics, and that's frankly a pretty easy standard to meet. So what we should be doing is talking about the fact that government is problematic, not that markets are perfect, because then we're defending a position we can't possibly win on. We can win on government sucking, because most people, yeah, it does, that's right.
All right, a question from Slido. I'm going to kind of combine a question from Phil Magnus and Hunter Oswald. They ask about, they want an explanation, basically, for the appeal of effective altruism among free market libertarian types. That it should be a contradiction, and yet it's something that they seem to be drawn to. And it turns into a sort of libertarian paternalism as well, in the case of the left. So where does that appeal come from? What's the psychology behind that, in your opinion?
I should be careful. There's two versions, one of which I actually find very sensible.
Okay.
So the sensible form of effective altruism would say that, well, remember Peter Singer's original claim. I'm walking past a shallow pond. I have inexpensive shoes. I see a child drowning in the pond. I should go in and save the child at absolutely no risk to myself because it'll just cost me the value of the shoes. Now, I learned that there is a child in Africa or South America that likewise is suffering. And at no more cost than the cost of a pair of shoes, I can end that suffering. Well, the difference is, and you know I'm going to say this, transaction costs. However, it is now possible for apps, GoFundMes, nonprofit organizations to acquire reputations and to be much more transparent about the way that they spend money. So the effective altruism movement is based on the claim that whatever you're going to contribute to charity, you should do that thing which produces the greatest net social welfare. And we can measure those things because we can learn by this competition of different advertising. I can actually get much more information than I could in Adam Smith's time, when Adam Smith compared, you know, the 100 million Chinese, but that was like a supernova. I didn't hear about it until months later. I hear about it that day, if it happens now. And I can send money via Bitcoin and have it have an effect this afternoon. So within 3 or 4 hours of the catastrophic event, I can have an impact if there's some infrastructure in place to make sure that it's actually delivered. So I think that's the sensible part of effective altruism. The odd thing about it is this concentration in some lordly person who is going to concentrate all the money and then do the right thing with it. So I think it's perfectly sensible to the extent that it is decentralized and based on new information gathering capacity. But it's not. It is not. Effective altruism focuses on maximizing expected utility and operating at scale. It is a lie.
Anyone else want to chime in? Okay, you covered it.
Question primarily to Mike Munger. So Jeff Bezos didn't want to create a local book club, right? He had a grandiose vision of an everything store, and we know how much he changed the world because of his relentlessness of that vision. And to change the world, it seems to me, those young people and to whom something like effective altruism or those grandiose ideals of mosquito nets, the metaphor you used, it's what appeals to them. It's the bigness and the grandioseness of their vision that they're idealistic and moralistic and they want to do great things. What your presentation kind of sounded like, and I don't think that's the purpose, but it might be taken as telling them, hey, don't be so ambitious and don't be so excited, right? Be careful, there is not much you can do almost. And I don't think an excited, idealistic young person will listen to you. So how would you make the local philanthropy, as you mentioned, more exciting and appealing as compared to this grandiose vision?
I would turn effective altruism on itself and say all of the initiatives to date that have tried to operate at scale have failed. And so if you actually want to have an effect, what you're going to need to do is to be able to enable local decentralized initiatives. That's much harder. But the fact is, your idea that by doing something big, you're doing something good is just wrong. What you're doing is wasting all of the resources. So if you're serious about wanting to change the world, you're going to fail if you try to do it at scale. It doesn't work. We've learned over and over again that those sort of centrally panned solutions, they don't work. And so if you're a consequentialist, the only game in town is decentralized, many different decentralized activities at scale. That's a lot harder. I find a lot of students at Duke whose plan is, as soon as they graduate from Duke, they're going to run a nonprofit for 2 years and change the world, and then they're going to go to law school. So it's a pretty short-term commitment that they're looking for, because in 2 years, an awesome person like me, I can change the world. Well, that's actually not true. So they're just mistaken about their consequentialist beliefs. So I would like to turn effective altruism on itself. And let's note, if I'm empirically wrong, that's great. There very well can be examples of Jeff Bezos or someone that actually does accomplish something that's enormous. Terrific. You can't do that. You would be much better off doing what you can rather than trying to do something awesome and fail.
Well, let me thank you, the panel, for a very interesting session. I think I would like to make a case and get your reaction, not for transaction costs, but for transaction profits. And I very much appreciate the overall effort of trying to apply entrepreneurship to cultural and educational efforts outside of the marketplace. Three great scholars of entrepreneurship, Frank Knight, Joseph Schumpeter, and Israel Kirzner, I think would all agree that the great proportion of entrepreneurs fail. We're not interested in those. We look at the successes, but numerically, most of them fail. I think that's a bit too narrow, because entrepreneurs that fail learn a lot, and most successful entrepreneurs first have failed a number of times. An entrepreneur, I think, needs, as was already stated, confidence and creativity. I have a good friend who's a free marketer. Says, I always wanted to be an entrepreneur, but I never had any ideas. And so he wasn't. Failure teaches you some humility. And so if you add confidence, creativity, and humility, you might have a recipe for a successful entrepreneur. And then you need, I think, a fourth thing, which is some intuitive empathy. Because if you're trying to get a product or an activity to succeed, you have to find a way to improve other people's lives. In other words, a satisfied customer is your customer because you have something to offer them that they think improves their lives. So that four-part combination might be called a transaction profit, that your efforts, even if they fail in an ostensible way, still is a stepping stone toward ultimate success. I'd just like your reaction to trying to do that on a cultural, educational direction. We don't have the marketplace to tell us have we succeeded or not. You succeeded with a student. You didn't get any extra money for doing that. And hopefully, as we try to improve the culture and the educational system, we don't have the marketplace to tell us how we've succeeded. But so I'd like to just ask your reactions to the concept of transaction profits.
Quick comment. I'll keep this very quick. I suppose maybe I would have talked about positive externalities rather than transaction profit. There is a certain element of the right kind, I'm going to say this word very cautiously, the right kind of virtue signaling, getting up every morning and trying to serve the consumer, not wearing a mask, trying to serve the consumer and trying to advance. And in the nonprofit sphere, the mere fact of trying to help and trying to make a difference. And this brings me back, I think it was Leonard Reed who suggested that Friends of Liberty can start by being a good example and living the kind of life to which other people aspire. So of course we want to change the world, that's what we want to do. But in the meantime, if we can be an example and change one or two or 10 students at the margin, there's something there and maybe they'll become professors. Thank you, Paul.
I want to add something. That's remind me a situation about culture and entrepreneurship. Here in the United States, if someone fail and he success, the other people like him because he has the experience and he can be avoiding those problems in the future. It's a lesson that he learned. In my country, if you fail once, you are look as a bad person and nobody wants him to work in your company. So that's a difference in culture. And I think it's better here because you have the opportunity to learn from your mistakes.
Anything to add? Okay. I want to get to another question from Slido. This is from Laura Jenkins. And it's about the problem of trying to use regulatory agencies to achieve, conservative, free market, pro-entrepreneurial ends when this just increases their power and leaves them vulnerable to capture by the left when they come into power. So I don't know if any of you were necessarily advocating that, but certainly I think a lot more can be said about that problem and the dynamics of it, especially kind of the popularity of wanting to take that strategy today.
Well, I think that's a pretty insightful question. So first, let me thank my good friend Styx Jenkins for having had that insight. There is a kind of entrepreneurship that is rewarded in politics, and that is the ability to use creative interpretations of the enabling statute to be able to promulgate a wider and wider set of rules and to capture a larger share of the budget. And they, as Mises said, you can't blame bureaucratic entrepreneurs for acting that way any more than you can blame a dog for eating out of the garbage. Now that was my part, not Mises, I'm paraphrasing. But that's what they do. And so that's what entrepreneurship is. And so you need, in a bureaucratic setting, you need to recognize, before you say we're going to create a bureaucracy to do this, that that's an unavoidable consequence. And so I think Laura's insight on that is right, and it's something we hadn't really talked about. The two kinds of entrepreneurship don't stand on a level playing field. For the most part, the consequences of economic entrepreneurship are either good, or if they're bad, they're borne by the individual. For the bureaucratic entrepreneur, the slow accretion of power through the creative application of legal reasoning, that's just very difficult to resist because you have to sue to prevent it. You have a thumb on the scale there on the expansion of power, so that's a good point.
Anything to add?
I think it's sorely tempting to use power that exists to advance good things, but it's like a constitution. The constitution is not written for me, it's written for the next person who comes in and will be tempted to use power because I can be trusted with power, well, until I have it. And I'm reminded of conversations I had at Hillsdale College with colleagues, including Nathan Schleter, my good friend with whom I wrote that book on conservatism versus libertarianism, who is very keen on using the state to advance virtue. And I said, well, I would trust the Secretary of Virtue Schleter, but then when the next election rolls around and Hillary Clinton gets her plum assignment as Secretary of Virtue, we're all in big trouble. And we've just
Donald Trump. It doesn't have to be it doesn't have to be a partisan point.
Oh absolutely. But the point is, anybody who's willing to wield that power, and bipartisan, sure, is going to be, and I was using that for effect with him, but we've created the institution. We've created one more dangerous ring of power. as it were, and I think the idea is we've got to step out of the way. Let's dismantle the welfare state. Let's dismantle government schools. Let's let civil society create virtue. Let's let the bourgeois virtues flourish in markets rather than using the power of the state under Democratic or Republican hands to advance those things, because it's just too dangerous. And thank you for that clarification.
To carry on that theme.
Ramon, did you have anything to add?
I'm fine. I'm fine.
Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
On that theme, I love the suggestion to send the administrative state to the fires of Mount Doom. We have a tool called the 10th Amendment, and my question is, do you know of, or would you be willing to look into, anyone who's looking at applying that to the next pandemic? We know there's going to be one, it's in the plan. I'm going to move myself up the watch list by attending our County Board of Health meeting next Wednesday and asking them to pass a 10th Amendment resolution that they intend to adhere to that and run the next pandemic. Don't know if they'll do it, but they're going to see me and a couple of other people, and we're going to come back. So I'd love company. I'd love help. I think other people should do it, because at a local level is where we can hold them accountable. And speaking of that, I'll end with, I read somewhere recently that when you talk about give unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, people think Caesar is the federal government. It's not. It's the people. We the people give them the power. So what do you know? What are you willing to do?
I'd be happy to talk. I've got a working paper now more focused on the state level and legislative review of governor emergency powers, but there certainly is something there. As far as the 10th Amendment goes, I love the idea, and I talk about it all the time, and I read it once a week to make myself happy, but I think that ever since the what we might call the Dirty Dozen New Deal jurisprudence cases, the emphasis is much more that the U.S., the federal government is allowed to do anything it wants except that which is prohibited by the Constitution, as opposed to an Article 1, Section 8, enumerated powers, 9th and 10th Amendment view. I fear that may be a non-starter given the intellectual climate, but I'm certainly happy to talk to you about it afterwards.
The 10th Amendment is dead in my mind because of the current composition of the court. Sandra Day O'Connor and William Rehnquist actually were 10th Amendment fans, but the new conservative majority sees nothing in the 10th Amendment that they think should restrict any kind of federal power. So they're extremely aggressive on the conservative side about eviscerating the 10th Amendment. It's hopeless.
All right, this is another one from Slido, which I find really fascinating. It's directed at Dr. Munger, but I think anybody can chip in as well. Could your critique of claims to teach entrepreneurship also be applied to those who claim to teach statesmanship?
Yes.
There we go. All right.
My name is William Willoughby. I am a strategist at Beckenstone and a Musean Fellow at the Institute. Thank you first and foremost for your speeches and insightful commentary. As I'm sure we all are, I assume we are all proponents of entrepreneurship. But I wanted to be clear just to define our terms and to very broadly categorize the potential impacts of entrepreneurship. Entrepreneurship is good when it results in a positive sum game, and it is bad when it results in a negative sum game. However, this is where I'm confused. What game exactly are we playing? And let me explain what I mean by this. Mr. Wenzel, this actually came up in your speech earlier, and if I'm getting this incorrect, please let me know. But there was mention of marijuana as a net positive or a win because it aids in the reduction of the size of the government, and no doubt generates magnificent profits, as I have seen firsthand. To provide, I guess, some useful context, in my little and often forgotten Midwestern town and neighborhood, since the beginning of COVID, 8 dispensaries have been put up within a 2-mile radius, and I have watched as the people about whom I care, my friends, the waitresses, the bartenders, the store clerks, the mechanics, have all become increasingly complacent with the ever-decreasing quality of their life as they pacify themselves with this product. But marijuana has resulted in an extremely positive sum monetary gain, but it has significantly resulted in a negative sum cultural or societal gain. So my question is, how do you make the distinction or decide which game the cultural or the monetary game is more important for the well-being of the country?
Good question.
So I think I'll jump in on that. Thank you. That was the importance of my caveat about the decay of civil society. So I think with a stronger civil society, we would have a lot fewer of those negative impacts. The positive impacts that I'm talking about, of course, are reduction in police force, civil asset forfeiture, no-knock warrants, and increasing local budgets, increasing, perhaps even leading to militarization of police, all tied in with the war on drugs, which has been a spectacular failure, just as the war on poverty has been. So, of course, there's a double-edged sword. Freedom implies the ability to use it. Freedom implies the virtue. Freedom implies a strong civil society within which to exercise that liberty. So the problem, I think, is not just a cost-benefit analysis. I was going to say a CBA, but perhaps CBD might be the better term in this case. So it's all part of a greater whole. And I do see a net positive in terms of reduction of the state. The problem is we're not operating in a vacuum. We do have a much weakened civil society, weakened families, weakened economic opportunity through regulation and job licensing, et cetera. So it's only one piece of the puzzle.
All right, we have time for one more. There's a question here about, again, directed at Dr. Munger, but I think anybody can answer. About getting beyond that dichotomy of market and state, and looking at the genuinely scalable, you know, nonprofit sector. And the question is about where do you see people succeeding? What are some examples of the sort of thing that you'd like to see more of? So I like the practical focus there.
My personal favorite, you know what I'm going to say, is GoFundMe. Where it's a very micro level, we need relatively small amounts at low transactions cost, we can get quite a bit very quickly, and if you have millions of those, the net effect, since they're so well targeted, is great. But there's a long tradition of an emphasis on the independent sector from Richard Cornell and other thinkers that talked about a sector that is not markets and it's not the state, but it's the essence of the Tocquevillian independent kind of society. And I was trying to blame myself for saying public choice people have not emphasized the existence of that alternative enough, allowing people to create structures that many, probably a third of the people in this room, work for some kind of organization that is a voluntary private organization that contributes to the social welfare according to their particular vision. And their efforts and their effectiveness all are examples of this. So the premise of the question, I always have trouble with that kind of question because I'm claiming scale doesn't work. And then the question is, well, can you give me an example where scale works? No, I can't.
All right, it is time for lunch. Please join me in thanking our panelists.
Okay.